Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds. Welcome to this special episode 100 of IDN. Since this podcast debuted in 2007, we've covered a lot of ground with lawyers, judges, mediators, arbitrators, and even scientists working in different continents and in different fields, all on the common subject of resolving conflicts. So to celebrate having reached episode 100, I decided to get a little personal with a very special guest, Eugenie Scott, and on a topic that almost always provokes emotional and apparently irreconcilable differences among opposing sides, the conflict between science and religion. I was a newly minted lawyer when I first met Jeannie Scott and the organization she leads, the National Center for Science Education, or NCSE, as it is known in the United States.
I contacted you because I needed help with a teacher who needed some advice because he was being leaned on for teaching evolution. And we had such a good telephone and email relationship for 6 or 9 months that when I was in New York once, I looked you up and after talking with you, I decided, you know, we could really use a lawyer on our board of directors, so we do go back a long ways.
NCSE is a small nonprofit organization based in Oakland, California, that defends the teaching of evolution in the public schools against efforts to inject science classes with religion. These efforts usually involve wrapping religious explanations of the natural world into scientific-sounding names like creation science or intelligent design theory, despite the fierce opposition of the scientific community and of science educators. NCSE is not a dispute resolution institution, but Jeannie spends a lot of time trying to resolve the most incendiary of these conflicts, often involving people's most deeply held views. But before getting to Jeannie's work, let's set the stage with some background on the history of the science-religion conflict in the United States, so you'll see why this is an appropriate topic for a podcast about resolving difficult disputes with people from different backgrounds and interests.
With the blessed Bible plan, you can't make a monkey out of me. You can't make a monkey out of me. Oh no. You can't.
The song in the background, "You Can't Make a Monkey Out of Me," comes from the United States in the 1920s. It was made popular during the trial of a high school science teacher, John Scopes, charged with violating a criminal law prohibiting the teaching of evolution in school. The famous Scopes trial, or monkey trial as it was called, pitted two of the greatest United States lawyers of the time against each other, the civil libertarian Clarence Darrow and the populist William Jennings Bryan. The trial was subsequently immortalized in a Broadway play and film, Inherit the Wind, which was a thinly fictionalized account of the events.
I call to the stand one of the world's foremost experts on the Bible and its teachings, Matthew Harrison Brady.
Your Honor, this is preposterous.
Brother, let us pray.
Well, it's highly unorthodox. I've never known an instance where the defense called the prosecuting attorney as a witness.
Your Honor, this entire trial is unorthodox.
Clarence Darrow's famous cross-examination of Jennings Bryan, renamed Matthew Brady in the film, came to symbolize to many people the triumph of modern scientific thinking over religion.
I don't suppose there are many portions of this book you've committed to memory, The Origin of the Species.
I am not the least interested in the pagan hypotheses of that book.
Never read it.
And I never will.
Then how in perdition have you got the gall to whoop up this holy war about something that you don't know anything about? How can you be so cocksure that the body of scientific knowledge systematized in the writings of Charles Darwin is in any way irreconcilable with the book of Genesis?
Would you state that question again, please?
But one of the things you learn in the field of dispute resolution is not to assume it's always a zero-sum game. For example, that in a battle between God and Darwin, that one of them has to lose. Maybe the battle itself is overstated or unnecessary. Or maybe a legal victory will come at too high of a price for the winning party. That's where Jeannie Scott and NCSE come in, with a defense of science education that is very different from the one advanced by Clarence Darrow on behalf of John Scopes. In this 100th episode of IDN, Jeannie explains how, despite what you might expect, most disputes over science and religion today can be resolved without denigrating the other side's views or, in most cases, going to court.
The issue really does have to do with whether a particular religious view is going to be inserted into the science class in public schools. It really isn't an issue of having people learn about religion. I mean, a comparative religion is fine. That's not the issue at all. It really does have to do with Establishment Clause issues. And the courts have actually been extremely consistent about this for 30 years or more. In every single case, 100% of the cases in which the teaching of evolution has figured into the issue, even if you claim scientific warrant for creationism, as in creation science or intelligent design, the burden of proof is upon the claimants to show that this is a valid scientific movement. That there is a secular purpose for teaching it. And in the case of creation science and recently in intelligent design, the proponents have simply failed to do this.
Right, so it ought to be on-off. It's either legal or not legal. And so it naturally leads towards litigation.
Yeah, and even though, as I say, we've had 100% success rate, these issues do crop up from time to time, largely because, if you'll pardon an obvious pun, of the evolution of creationism. They keep trying to come up with new versions of creationism, like creation science in the 70s and 80s and intelligent design in the 90s and 2000s. But it's, you know, and so in one sense, yeah, every time we've gone to court, we've won, and that makes is happy, but you really don't want to go to court. I mean, I hate to say this to a bunch of lawyers, but if we have to go to trial, we consider we've failed, because our whole goal is to solve these problems so that they don't get to the to the stage where you've got to have some sort of a litigation. If we can solve these problems behind the scenes, get people to compromise, perhaps get people to understand what the issues are. In some cases, especially after the court decisions that have been so strong in keeping creationism out of the schools, in some cases, just calling attention of the school board to the fact that they are on legally very shaky ground. I mean, you know, in more than one case, when a school board member or a teacher or a parent has called us saying, hey, our school board wants to do X, Y, or Z, we say, well, tell your school board to consult their legal retainer, and this problem is very likely to go away.
So that's
one of the things we can do.
But what I've seen over the years, though, is where in negotiation terms, we talk about positions, where the Constitution is a position. You know, the science versus nonsense is really maybe the underlying interests, the interests of the schools to teach what is valid science and to provide a valid education to students. What I've seen going on for years is this ability to find who the people are, who the decision makers are, and explain to them how to meet their underlying interests. One of them being, by the way, how to teach evolution without making it appear to be in conflict with religion.
Exactly. One of the first things that you need to do is figure out who the stakeholders are. And I learned a lot about who the stakeholders are in this controversy when I was a college professor in Kentucky back in the early 80s. And we had one of these local conflicts over whether evolution should be taught. This, by the way, was in like 1980, 81.
By the way, for listeners who come from outside the United States, we should note that in the mid-1980s, the United States Supreme Court decided or held that teaching creationism was, in effect, teaching religion. And teaching religion runs against the Constitution of the United States. It's not considered something you should be able to do, at least in the public schools.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so what I learned in dealing with this local controversy and now an approach that I've applied ever since in working for NCSC for the last 25 years or so, is that you need to look at teachers as one group of stakeholders. You have to look at administrators as another. Then there's the school board. And a very
outside of that direct chain of command of the school system itself, you've got the parents. And they have somewhat different interests from the actual school system itself. At NCSC, our approach is to take something of a 1-2 approach. The first thing we go in with is what's best for the students. What is the best science education for the kids? What you want to go for is the consensus view of science, the view of science that the scientists agree upon, not the aspects that they might still be fighting about. And ironically, they're not fighting about creationism at all. It's not even, you know, they're no more fighting over creationism than they're fighting over, you know, Italian Renaissance art. I mean, that's right. Not a topic that they're concerned about. And we also point out that although evolution is not compatible with some religious beliefs, it is highly compatible and is incorporated into mainstream Christianity, Catholicism, and mainstream Protestant Christianity.
Right, and NCSC has actually put together a fair amount of materials to explain to teachers and to school boards how to teach evolution so as not to make students feel threatened about their religion.
Exactly. You know, you have to respect the sincerity of the beliefs of the people you're dealing with. And one of the ways of assuaging those beliefs is actually quite simple. But like a lot of solutions to problems, sometimes just making the simple explicit is a good solution. And that is just to point out to a concerned parent, say, that, well, the job of the science teachers in our district is to present the consensus view of science to students so that the students will be educated and will know what science is and what the major ideas are. The job of your student is to learn this. Now, nobody is saying that your student has to accept anything that is taught. You know, you don't have to accept that planets go around the sun. You can believe that the sun goes around the earth, whatever. I mean, but you do have to learn what the standard scientific view is. You don't have to accept evolution if you don't want to, but you do have to learn what it is and that it is the standard scientific explanation. And it's funny because teachers tell me that when they lay this out to parents, it has this effect of assuaging their concerns. Oh, good, we thought he had to believe it. And no, that's not what that's not education, that's indoctrination. And of course, what, ironically enough, what often happens is that when students relax a little bit and take the fingers out of the ears, so to speak, and actually listen to what evolution truly is, as opposed to what they've been told about it, they find out that it's not really this terrible, scary idea that requires them to give up their faith. It's a description of how the world works, and right. That's kind of what all science is about.
I would love if listeners could hear you explain the difference between fact and theory, because as it comes up often in the evolution, quote-unquote, controversy, people will say, well, it's only a theory. You shouldn't be teaching evolution as a fact. Evolution is just a theory. And you explain that, well, the Earth going around the sun is the theory of heliocentrism is a theory, or gravity is a theory, and to explain scientifically what a theory is.
Right. You notice that we've actually talked for a fairly long time, and I've never used the T word except I accidentally slipped it out in a paragraph or two back. And I do avoid using the word theory because of exactly what you say, because there's this real confusion in people's mind as to what a theory is. And it's because, you know, like a lot of words, we use words on the street and then we use them as terms of art. The word theory is a term of art in science, and we use it differently than people use it when they just use it casually. Theory to us in science is an inferential explanation. And the explanation is really at the heart of theory. It's not a guess or a hunch or some half-baked idea, which is kind of the way we, you know, that's your theory, bud, when we're using
right,
it on
right.
the street. And you know, the thing about theories versus facts, theories explain facts. A fact in science is a confirmed observation. It's sort of the lowest common denominator, so to speak, of the scientific process. The world is full of facts. Facts become important and useful when they are organized into theories. So, you know, another kind of word that's used differently is law, because the way it's used in both the legal profession and on the street is much more similar to one another than the way scientists use the word law. To you and most people on the street, laws are something that can't be broken. I mean, laws are something that are just really, really, really important, and you respect them because you don't want to break laws. In science, a law is a descriptive generalization, which is a very useful thing. You know, that's something like Mendel's laws. Mendel's laws talking about how the hereditary material passed through the generations, and it's a very useful thing. But it's really the theories that take the laws and form them into powerful explanations that is the most important thing in science. So some people have this idea that a really good theory grows up to be a law, and that's actually not the case at all. Theories explain laws, and theories explain facts.
Well, but, you know, I think that you find a lot of sympathy with trial lawyers or litigation lawyers who use facts to support a story or to find out what the truth is. I mean, it's, you know, need the facts, you put the facts together, they make up a very strong theory. We know that the Earth goes around the sun because of a number of facts which lead us to that conclusion.
And it's actually an inference. And in fact, heliocentrism, the idea that planets go around the sun.
Not everybody accepts that, by the way. I mean, there may be some people out there who don't think it does, you know.
Yeah, there are people who are geocentrists.
But, you know, it's really interesting, though, Jeannie, is how, and I think about CPR, which sponsors this podcast, you know, encourages parties to find out-of-court ways of resolving their conflict, and how NCSE has always, you know, tried to pioneer this in an area that is, it just goes to the deepest beliefs of people, the deepest and most important beliefs that people have, in a way that is respectful of those beliefs. But it also shows you how, you know, the courts, you know, really often aren't going to be able to provide the ideal solution. The ideal solutions are in the ability of people to work out resolutions to their problems. You know, and I think about the case that you and I, you know, you got me involved in, and I spent a lot of time on, you know, a teacher who was sanctioned for teaching, he was disciplined for teaching evolution. And we fought that battle for him. We fought it legally at one point. And he was, somebody who was very proud to be a science teacher. And I remember looking back on that, and it had a big impact on me that we won that case. I mean, and mm-hmm. the result was he quit teaching. The whole going through the legal process, having to defend himself.
Like I always say, if we have to go to court, then we've failed. Because our goal is to try to resolve these without having to go to the agony and the expense and the exhaustion of a court case. So if we can solve these problems behind the scenes, get people to appreciate what the issues are, how can you present good science in your school district? But it's a 1-2 punch. The second punch is, and by the way, every time anybody has gone to court with this issue, you have lost. So it's very unwise for you to do this. But, you know, we lead, you know, we try to appeal to people's better angels. We try to appeal to what they should think is important, which is doing the best job possible educating the students.
Well, and then let's take that to where NCSE may be going next, which is NCSE is going to get into climate science.
Yeah, and that's a completely different situation.
It's a very, very different.
For your listeners. Yeah. Just for your listeners, indeed, there's pressure upon teachers in the U.S. And, alas, in other countries as well, about the teaching of evolution, mostly motivated by religious views. But there's also pressure upon teachers in the U.S. to not talk about global warming. There's been in the last few years a concerted effort of anti-global warming proponents to spread the idea that the science of global warming is weak, that it's really just a conspiracy of big government people who are trying to tell us what to do. I mean, there's all sorts of kind of goofy ideas that are percolating out in here. But the bottom line for us, and the reason why we just recently decided to enter this area, is that teachers are being pressed to qualify good science in the climate category, just like they're being pressed to qualify good science in the evolution category. Now, that's the similarity for us, and of course, there also are similarities in the way that the arguments are constructed and a number of other things that make us feel that we might be able to make a difference in this controversy in helping teachers to use some of our experience that we gained in dealing with evolution for so long. We've known for quite a long time, really, from a lot of social science research, that that people don't change their opinions about things just because you shovel more factual knowledge on top. And just like in evolution, we could present all of the factual information about evolution on the planet and still not change the mind of a school board member unless you dealt with that school board member's concern that a kid's going to lose his faith if he learns evolution, because that is what is keeping the fingers in the ears. And similarly with climate change, we're going to have to work with the emotional and ideological opposition to climate change information. Because unless some of those worries are assuaged, all the factual knowledge about the science of climate change isn't going to penetrate.
Many theories are spent on the origin of man. Some can trace some name.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation, the podcast of the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. For questions or comments, please write to idn@cpradr.org.
No, no, I am human through and through. All my aunts and uncles too. And you can't make a monkey out of me.